This is tape 6, side B of the Open University course English 102, Composition in Native Indian Literature 1. On this tape, course author Patty Hartford talks to Morris Kenney, the author of Rain. This interview was recorded at the Open Learning Agency in Burnaby on February 16, 1993. Morris Kenney is in his office at North Country Community College in New York State, and Patty Hartford is at her home in Kamloops.
I really want to know what it is that you've been doing here for the last few weeks. I mean, I know you've been...
I've been out traveling across the United States and British Columbia doing readings promoting my new book, Tekwanwadonte, Molly Brandt, which is a collection of dramatic monologue or persona poems dealing with the historical woman, Molly Brandt, of the 18th century, and her life and times, and marriage with Sir William Johnson. So that's what I've been doing for the last, golly, I guess 8 weeks.
So when you're not traveling around, what do you do?
Well, I also, besides writing, of course, I teach, and I teach at various schools. I go as visiting professor or poet in residence. I've been at the University of Oklahoma and the Inaukun Center in British Columbia, Paul Smith College up here in northern New York, and other places. I do a lot of workshops, too, at various art centers across the land.
You really get around.
Yes, I do. Too much. Too much.
So I would love to know what it is that made you decide to become a writer.
Oh, I had no choice in the matter. Since a very young boy, I have needed to write. I guess for various kinds of reasons. I felt that, I was a very shy boy, didn't do a lot of talking, and decided perhaps the best way of talking was to write or sing songs, because I actually started singing songs rather than writing them down. And it was probably during my adolescence I realized I could actually write these songs down. But there wasn't a decision on my part. I did not choose to be a writer. Actually, I had wanted to be a jockey. I wanted to be a horse jockey. And if I had any early training, that's what I had.
Great. Well, did you ever have any of these songs published?
Yes, I did. Again, as an adolescent, I published quite a few of these little pieces in old places like newspapers, mainly the Syracuse Post-Standard, the Watertown Daily Times, places like that. They weren't very good, and I hope they're lost. Oh, I fear they're not.
We won't hear them on the radio then or anything like that.
I hope not.
So when you write, do you write about things that happen to you personally?
Not necessarily. Everything must come out of our experience, but it can be a re-experience of someone else's. Obviously something that has touched you and moved you, but no, not always out of my own experiences, no. Not always. I like to think of the poet, the creative writer, the fiction writer, as being a medium, and with eyes and ears open, listening to the echoes of time itself, plus your own moment. So that I don't think of myself as being writing just out of my own experiences. I do have a collection of poems called the Mama Poems, which are very personal poems dealing basically with my mother after she died. But I don't think of the other poems as being quite so personal. Though I use the possessive I use it in the collective sense of really we. I dance for the nation, meaning we dance for the nation.
What do you think is the most important thing for Native people to write about, or is there such a thing?
Oh, history. History. I've been drilling this for years. and many of us ignore it. Perhaps we don't know it, but we should find it out. The history of the continent includes Native people, not just Anglos of Canada, United States, and Mexico. It's our history, too. And in my classes, whether it's creative writing or a history class or an English lit class, I do push that idea very heavy to my students, and particularly my Native students. Write your history. Write of your great leaders, the great men and the great women who have come before you, and that you're here because of them, because they were here and what they did, their successes, not just their failures. I'm getting a little tired of reading stories and poems about drunken Indians and gutters. That's not the only thing we are. We're much bigger than that. A few of us have fallen, but many of us are strong. And should be helping those people who are in the gutters. History is very important. I have two books. The Molly Brandt is a historical record, and my other book, Black Robe, Isaac Jogue, is another historical record.
So you're talking about personal history as well as the broader scope.
As well as a broader scope, as well as the culture, the history of the culture of each individual nation. I don't see, with the talents that we have of Native people as writers and artists, why we can't write the stories and the poems of the Crazy Horse and the Red Jackets and the Sacagaweas. Why have other people do it? We have that same talent. We have that same talent. And if we're not as knowledgeable as we should be, it is readable. You can read it and then rewrite it.
So what's your feeling about non-Native writers who take on these tasks, particularly writing fiction about Native people?
Well, that's a very important question of our time, and I have struggled with it. I feel that if we're not going to write the great epic, the great poetic epic of Crazy Horse, and if they want to, then let them. At least he lives a little longer that way. But I think it's our duty, our obligation, and a legacy for the Native person to go and write that epic poem on Crazy Horse or Red Jacket or whomever. So if we don't want to, and they do, let them do it. And I have struggled a long time with this, a long time, as I think many, many writers do.
Well, who are some of your own favorite writers?
Contemporary writers?
Hmm. Or,
Native writers?
Who aren't contemporary.
Who aren't contemporary?
Either one.
Oh, okay. Darcy McNichol in fiction is certainly one of my favorite writers, Native man. Leslie Marmon Silko, contemporary speaking. Peter Bluecloud, Wendy Rose, Jeanette Armstrong, both as a writer, as a visionary, as an educator, an incredible woman. Great vision. Simon Ortiz is another, Joy Harjo. Non-Native writers, Faulkner is probably, my God, I don't know, in fiction anyway. I just finished about a half an hour before you called an essay on Denise Lerbatov and what I as a poet learned from her. I think she's a major voice of our time, perhaps the major voice in lyric poetry of our time. Hopkins, Gerard Manley Hopkins, I gained a great deal from in reading as a student. Robinson Jeffers, another strong favorite. Yes, and even Eliot. Yes, Eliot. Quite a few.
You've named several of my favorites too, and I think the reason that we both like them is probably their strong imagery.
Oh, of course. In this essay on Lerbatov, that's what I'm talking about. It's her image, metaphor, symbol, --. Yes, absolutely. I'm an image maker, if I dare to use that term. I'm an image maker. I like to think in terms of photographing or painting in a poem or in a story, which I learned probably from William Carlos Williams to do that. I was a frustrated painter, and I cannot work a camera. And in this particular story, in Rain, I used the camera there as an image, as though the speaker of the poem is actually photographing the dance and the rain in his own country, in his own home country. I purposely used to photograph the camera there.
So you're using the camera with words anyway?
With words. I hunt with words. I photograph with words. I paint with words. I sing with words. I dance with words. Words, language, the power of language. Intriguing and mesmerizing at the same time.
Well, it certainly shows through in Rain. What do you think is your best work?
Oh, golly, I'm still working. The next book, probably.
So far.
Oh, I don't know. I have a wide choice. What do I have, 24, 25 books? Right now, I think, is Molly Brandt. But everyone tells me it's the Mama poems. As a single piece in fiction, I have a new story that's called Blue Jacket that's in the third edition of Gatherings. And I think because it's so new and just been printed, that might be my favorite piece of fiction. But it's always the next book. It's the book you're working on, the essay you're working on, the new poem you're working on, which is a favorite. You have to put things aside, otherwise you won't develop and you won't grow. And growth and development is so important in art, whether you're a painter, writer, sculptor. We must grow.
So what kind of feedback do you get about your work?
My publisher sends me very few reviews. He doesn't want to swell my head, I guess. Usually pretty good. I think I've only had really one bad review in my career as a writer, and that particular reviewer didn't even like the design of the book, let alone the poems in it or the art on the cover. I mean, she just absolutely hated the entire book. But usually they're pretty good. They're pretty positive.
And how do you react?
Feedback from my students is more important to me than feedback from my reviewers, as I teach creative writing, and I have a lot of students who, over the years, still stay with me, and they stay with me because I think not so much that I'm a great teacher, but that I'm a good writer, and they're learning things from my writing, which I did from my teachers.
How do you respond when you get a critical review like the one you mentioned?
Oh, I was very angry. I didn't respond to her through a letter or telephone call in any way like that. You just don't do that. She has her rights to her opinions. But I was very angry, and my first thought was, you never read my book. You just heard the title and decided to write something about the title. Yeah, it bothered me a good deal. I don't pay attention a lot to reviews, even when I see them, though. It's one person's opinion, and usually it's an Anglo person reviewing you, and they'll say silly things like, oh, well, how can I understand this poem? I'm not Indian. Mm. Well, we're using the same language, though, are we not?
Right.
I mean, if I use the word, the noun, the image of wolf, it has an extra connotative meaning to it than perhaps the reviewer would have. The reviewer probably would see the wolf as something dangerous and fierce and evil, and I see it as something being very noble and being destroyed. Mm-hmm. That would be the only difference, some connotative kind of suggestion or implication in that particular image or metaphor.
So speaking of image and metaphor, let's go to Rain.
Okay.
I'm dying to hear you read from it.
Okay. I think we decided to start where it begins, Men Beat Drums.
Okay.
Now, I have with me on my lap the University of Oklahoma edition of the book.
Okay.
And in that one, it's on page 142.
Okay. I think, well, it's on page 142 of the book we have, too.
So. Oh, okay. Same page. All right.
Okay.
All right. Men beat drums. The dancers slowly proceed into the plaza. The man lifting the guidon of penance follows. Two single lines of dancers, women, men follow the lead woman in the green tennis shoes. Their faces are stained red. The men's chests are stained blue. The cedar forests of arms move into the center of the pueblo. Bare feet kick up puffs of red dust. Men shake rattles. Drummers drum. The guidon lowers. Drummers drum, even, loud, incessantly. The sun hovers. Light falls upon Mount Taylor. The dark cloud has moved off the mountain peak. The dark mesa clears. Dancers move across the plaza before a silent horde of people. Minutes pass, perhaps hours. No one counts time because time is neither recognizable nor of any importance. The dancers move, interchanging, stepping forwards, backwards, weaving, drumming the earth with their naked feet. Men slide between women to regroup another line. Rattles shake. The guidon lowers again to the earth, the dry dust, yet refuses to touch the earth. Drums drum. Brown bodies shine in the sweat of the dance. Paint melts on the flesh. The sun grudgingly moves before the cloud. The photo is animated before the fierce, disbelieving eyes of the crowd. The sweet smell of burning sage permeates the air. The crowd is still, breathless. Gnats hang onto the fetid air. The cloud moves. Drums drum. A shadow crosses the dancers' faces and the crowd under the umbrellas in the adobe pueblo of the mesa. Drums drum. The guidon lowers. Rattles rattle. I am a stranger in this part of the country. Rattles rattle. The guidon lowers but still does not touch the red, dusty earth. They sure have power in this pueblo, the matriarch exclaims. That's power, grandmother. The blind old grandfather, sitting with his grandson between his parted knees, relaxes in his folding chair, his face to the sky, to the cloud, to the expected rain. He turns the boy's face with its mutton hands to the sky. He mumbles a prayer to himself, and then into the ear of the little boy, and to the impending rain. Perhaps he remembers his own youth, his own dance in that plaza years and years before, when his feet were strong and supple, not swollen as now, when his dreamy eyes sparkled with expectancy and could watch the cloud move across the quivering mesa to the pueblo, when his hand shook the rattles, the paint smeared and running down his chest naked to the falling pellets of cool rain. And his arms were festooned with the boughs bound in the turquoise bands. He smiled a slight grin, showing old teeth the color of dried corn. But the smile changes into a dark frown as his ear catches the din of the carnival outside the plaza, with the music of the merry-go-round vying with the beat of the drums, the rattles, and the pounding feet of the dancers. What chance has rain with this mechanical noise frightening the cloud and the spirits of the sky? His own grandchild begging for cotton candy and a swirl on the Ferris wheel. His people stuffing themselves with hot dogs and cokes. Changes. Everything changes now. He was glad to be blind. One day soon, he would be deaf. Yet before that biological change, he would start the little boy learning the steps, the shake of the rattle, help him to prepare the costume, hunt his coyote with bow and arrow, and teach him how to forge the bands to bind the cedar to the arm muscle. The boy would learn. The child stood between the knees of his grandfather, shaking a clenched but empty fist as the rain slowly dropped from the sky. Power, that's power, the elderly Laguna woman whispered. The lead dancer in the green tennis shoes falls out of line and accepts a drink of water from a girl at the edge of the plaza. Feet move and shuffle. Red and blue paint runs sweaty flesh, mingled, dripped the dust puffing up and flying away from the dry earth. power, whispers the voices in the plaza. The long two lines of dancers stand like falling raindrops caught in the eye of the camera, a photograph. Whispers breathe across the plaza, the small village of adobe houses, with the beat of the drum and the soft shuffle of feet and the rattle of the gourds. I am a stranger here in this part of the country. I sniff the burning sage. I feel the first drop of rain strike my hot cheek, my earlobe, feel it slide through wisps of my hair. The old woman in the green tennis shoes leads her dancers into the falling rain. Dust settles, the dancers' feet cake with mud. Drums drum, rattles rattle, rain. The old grandfather is first to stand. He folds his chair, places his hand in the small fist of his grandson, and urges the boy to lead him from the plaza. At the roadside, I buy a melon. The vendor cuts into small wedges. I suck the sweet juices and taste my grandmother's Macintosh, my mother's strawberries, my father's plums. I buy three more melons from the couple at the side of the road and take them back to Albuquerque. They sure can dance down the rain in that Santa Ana village. Sure can, mother. Mama, there's a rainbow. The tail. And there was. Down the road a few yards ahead of us walked the old grandfather and the boy in stumbling gait. I watched him turn onto a path leading deep into the mesa as the Pontiac passed and sped on. I am a stranger to this country. I am visiting a short while.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Sorry, my voice is so smoky this morning.
Well, considering the schedule you've had over the last little while, that's perfectly understandable. I just find this such a fascinating story because of the juxtaposition of these powerful poetic images. What effect did you anticipate in creating the image of the photograph?
Oh, golly. I don't know if I can answer that. I wanted to give the impression that one, the narrator is a stranger among strangers, and as a tourist, even though the narrator is a native person, he's still walking in and doing something wrong in the sense of photographing, even though it's only in memory, photographing this particular ceremony. I have been at rain dances, and I was upset by the attitude of the visitors that were there, laughing at this, that, and the other thing, and being more concerned with the carnival effect than the ceremony itself. I guess that's why I wanted to use the camera.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
The camera being something that was evaluating the past of the narrator and the present and the changes itself, recording those changes.
What about the images of the strawberries and melons, those beautiful, rich images?
Yeah, I can't get away from them. The strawberry is probably my central image of all my work. It moves in and out of everything I write, whether it's a critical essay or whatever. It just moves in and out. The experiences that I had as a child, as a small boy, with my mother and sisters and aunts, cousins in the strawberry fields has been a very important time in my life. It was a good time. It was a happy time. And, of course, knowing the Iroquois ceremony of the strawberry and its significance, it's become the central image, the central metaphor in my work.
Mm-hmm.
And because of that, I try to heighten its richness.
And the contrast here makes it even more rich.
Yes, because of the sweet waters in the berries and the plums and the apples that are not there in the desert of the Pueblo in the desert there. where rain is so utterly important and doesn't happen very often.
You mentioned
or the waters of the corn.
Sorry. You mentioned a little bit the narrator.
Mm-hmm.
And I found the narrator rather ambiguous. That is, I wasn't sure whether the narrator was a man or a woman and or what brought him or her to the rain dance. And you mentioned that the narrator was Native, but I didn't pick that up as I was
Not many people have, and that, I think that's very strange. The narrator is androgynous. I meant the narrator to be androgynous, but I meant the narrator to be certainly Native. Mm-hmm. His feelings, emotions, intentions are to the grandfather rather than that mixed family of the Laguna people. That's the whole litany of the grandmother being a full blood and then marrying a non-Indian, and then the mother doing the same thing, and then the granddaughter doing the same thing, and then who will the son marry and how much blood will be left. Mm-hmm. I think only a Native person would think in those terms. And I thought by doing that the clue, without making statements, this narrator is Native, I wanted to suggest it rather than to state it. I don't believe in statement. I believe in suggestion or implication. Show it, don't tell it. But a number of people have asked that very question, is the narrator Native? And the sex of the narrator isn't important. It isn't important at all.
Mm-hmm. And I noticed that you used he.
I used he? Yeah, well, I would. But, you know, I'm male, so I would normally automatically be a chauvinist and use he as a male.
Okay.
But I meant the narrator to be androgynous.
Okay. Now, the biographical notes that are at the end of all my relations say that you're primarily a poet, and from your publications that
yes.
Is certainly evident. Is that how you consider yourself?
Yeah, I think my first love is poetry, and it's only in recent years that I discovered I actually could write fiction. And I do have a book titled Rain and Other Fictions, in which this story appears. And that has been very, very, very well received, sells very well in the bookstores. I don't read from it because the stories are too long at a reading to give. And I'm just now putting another collection of fictions together, too. And I call them fictions rather than stories, because I really don't tell stories. I try to create characters and ceremony. I really don't tell stories. But I've been fairly pleased, not contented, but fairly pleased with what's come out of me as a fiction writer. And I feel as we grow older, and I know it's true with me, that as we grow older, we lose the lyrical voice. We don't sing anymore. And I've been moving into both the narrative and the dramatic forms much more than I'm dealing with the lyric form. And I use it all, you know. This particular story, Rain, is poetry. I think I look at it as being poetry, mm-hmm. not just fiction. It's a fiction, but it's very lyrical, I think.
Yes, it certainly is. Have you worked with longer fictions? Like, have you attempted a novel?
No. No. Do not plan to. Well, if you think in the sense that Molly Brandt, which is 216 pages, a long narrative epic poem on this woman's life, you might think in terms of that being a novel. And Isaac Jogue, of Black Robe, the same would apply there. It's also his life and times. And so in a sense, because they're also persona poems, in a sense that's a novel too. Novel's a lot of hard work, and I'm not about to do it. I don't have time to do it anyway.
Right. Well,
but yeah. I've been enjoying writing fiction a great deal. And in the last probably 5 to 8 years, my successes or triumphs are probably in fiction rather than in poetry. I think I feel that way.
Well, if all of your fiction is as poetic as Rain, then you've combined the best of both.
I hope so. I hope so.
When we first talked, you said that you would answer questions about technique, but not about meaning. So yeah.
I don't like taking the spirit out of a story or out of a poem. I don't do that with my own work, and even when I'm reviewing or criticizing, in a positive manner, I mean, someone's work, like the Larivitov piece right now that I've just finished working on this morning, I try not to take the spirit out of the piece. The magic, I don't think I have the right to touch the magic of it. But in the sense of technique, I don't mind talking about technique, if I have any at all.
So what do you tell your students about ways to interpret and understand a literary work?
Well, in creative writing, we stay away from the meaning of the poem. When we're critiquing each other's work, we don't touch it unless it's something so terribly offensive. And I remember a couple of years ago at the University of Oklahoma, a student wrote a poem dealing with the goodness of skinheads. And that affected everyone in the class that particular time. In that poem, we discussed the meaning in the poem and tried to point out to him the skinheads were not necessarily good people, such as in Germany right now, where they're killing and wounding immigrants in Germany, or what we do in the United States. There are a lot of Ku Klux Klansers still around, and they're called skinheads too. Mm-hmm. But other than that, I don't. We work a lot with image, with object, with metaphor, line ends, and the surprise of line breaks. Language itself, using the connotative rather than the denotative word, kind of thing, to edit as much as one possibly can. There's always another word we can edit out of a short poem and make it richer and fuller.
So on the same note, what advice would you give to a student in this course who's about to read Rain?
If they could not just read it with the eye, but read it with the ear and read it with the blood. What I mean is with passion, because I wrote it in passion, or with passion, with feeling, to dwell on certain words, to savor them, particularly the connotative or symbolic words. There are a lot of symbolic words in that particular piece, which would help explain the idea behind it, and perhaps the meaning will explode then on their intellect and their imagination. And they should go into it using the imagination more than the intellect. Feel it, smell it, sense what's going on. I use a lot of sensory impressions in there, as you remarked earlier. And so they have to read it with their senses. And read it slowly. Most students don't read slowly. Read it out loud.
Thank you so much. I'm going to go read it again.
Okay.
Thank you. I really enjoyed our conversation.
Me too.